Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
And welcome to Pop Talk. Hi, Mary Jane Popp here. Thanks so much, Mike. Hey, we got a good show for you today. It is jam-packed. Later on, Joyce Keller is going to join us. She's an internationally renowned psychic medium. She's written so many books. Her latest one is called Calling All Angels. And you know me, I love angels, so we're going to be talking about that. But we also are going to be talking about the end of the world. Are you ready? Is it closer than you think? We're going to talk about civilization and its fate just a little bit later. But before we do that, have we got a special guest for you. A little something of everything, from visionary poet to tarot cards and life lessons and, well, you name it. We've got it right here on Pop Talk. I'm Mary Jane Popp, and you know I'm going in search of truth. Have you ever heard of tarot cards, or tarot, depends on how you want to pronounce it? Can they fortune tell your life and what's to come? Are they warnings? Are they written in granite? Boy, lots of questions, so we need answers. Well, Julia Gordon Bramer is a professional tarot card reader and award-winning author. You've probably seen her on Nickelodeon, MTV. I can just go on and on and on. Her books? How about Fixed Stars Govern of Life, Decoding Sylvia Plath and Her Latest Tarot Life Lessons. Nice to have you with us, Julia.
Hi, nice to be here, Mary Jane.
Okay, so is it pronounced tarot or tarot?
You know, it doesn't matter. I say tarot. A lot of people say tarot. You know, it's just kind of how you want to put the accent. I say the only way you could go wrong is if you rhyme it with carrot.
Oh, there's.
You never want to say carrot.
Yeah, sort of like tomatoes, you know,
yeah.
That kind of thing. Okay, so let's talk. I want to talk about Sylvia Plath first before we get to the tarot stuff, okay?
Yeah, and actually, you said my latest book was Tarot Life Lessons. That's actually not true.
No.
And Tarot Life Lessons came out in November of last year, but my book, The Occult Sylvia Plath, came out in May of this year, so just last month.
Oh, cool. Well, let's talk about that because it's so interesting. When I found out about, you know, I did a little bit of reading because I didn't know that much about Sylvia Plath. I really didn't. But my sister-in-law was a librarian at the Graduate School Library, and she was a professor at IU. We were both, you know, from Indiana University, yada, 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 all that.
She said,
oh, well, the Lilly Library has an extensive collection of Sylvia Plath. And I said, oh, really? She said, first when she donated, I guess, some stuff. And then when she passed away, what, 77, was it?
Sylvia Plath?
Yeah.
Plath died in 1963.
Oh, yeah. 63.
The year I was born.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Okay. Well, she said in 77, maybe that's when her mother died or something. I don't know. But they said her mother donated everything, even the letters that she had from her daughter.
Right. Yeah. The Lilly Library's Sylvia Plath archives, there are two main Plath archives, and that's one of them. The other main archive is at Smith College in Northampton, in Massachusetts, and where Sylvia went to school. But Plath's mother was kind of a hoarder, and she kept everything. And so for the last 15 years, I've been sitting in the archive where you said your sister-in-law, is that?
Yeah,
where your sister-in-law works. I've been reading the books that Plath read and making notes of Plath's underlinings and marginalia and her little, you know, calendars and scrapbooks and all of the things that have not been published but were loaded with, you know, hard evidence of a practice in mysticism specifically.
But mysticism or occult, what's the difference?
It's kind of the same thing. What I would say, the word occult just means hidden, just like the moon has occult phases. And the occult is not known by the masses. Mysticism is generally a term for practice of the occult. Hmm. So ceremonies and rituals, and mysticism usually has the purpose of kind of self-actualizing and rising to your highest potential. It's different from witchcraft. The occult can cover witchcraft, but mysticism is sort of a higher energy. So it's about becoming your most powerful self, even your God self, kind of uniting with those energies and reaching your highest potential. So a mystic has that higher goal in mind.
Okay. Now, she and her husband, was it Ted Hughes? Didn't they work together?
Yes. So Ted Hughes was very much her mentor. Oh. He taught her so much. She worshipped him. And it's really crazy because his work has been widely examined, and people have written many books about his occult activities and witchcraft and Kabbalah and astrology and, you know, and all of this stuff woven in. And yet no one thought to look at Platt's work, which is just bizarre to me. But as I am a professional tarot card reader, I think, you know, maybe you had to be both a Platt scholar and a tarot scholar to see it. And so that was me, and I found this work. I discovered that Platt's tarot imagery in her poetry, in her book Ariel, during graduate school, and I brought it up to my professor, and I said, you know, what's this about? This is so clear that, you know, this is this card, and this is that card, and she's referencing such and such, and I explained it to my professor, and he looked at me just utterly confused, and he said, I've never heard anything about this. Huh. And he suggested that I make it my semester end project, and it became my life's work.
Oh, for heavens. Now, did she also use the Ouija board?
She used everything. Yeah, she used, you know, there's a photograph on the occult Sylvia Plath of her. It's an actual photograph of Plath herself holding a crystal ball.
Oh, really?
She used the Ouija board. She did bibliomancy. She did witchy bonfires. She did automatic writing.
Wait a minute, witchy bonfires? What's that?
Yeah. When she and her and Ted Hughes were breaking up, when she was quite upset with him. He was cheating on her and had basically left her high and dry with two young children, and she wanted to make him pay. And she's been seen by neighbors, and her mother have both written of her having these bonfires where she put in Ted's fingernail clippings and dandruff.
Oh, boy.
Got from the desk. And
almost sounds like voodoo. Did she stick pins in a doll?
Who knows? I wasn't there to see it. But yeah, she definitely wanted to exact a spiritual kind of revenge on him in the end.
Amazing. Okay, so what did you learn from or about Sylvia that has kept you going all these years and wanting to know more?
Yeah, you know, I think what it is, and maybe this is just my sympathy, empathy, being a woman, being a female poet myself as well, but it angered me that she's just been put in this box for 60 years now where, you know, you ask somebody who Sylvia Plath was, and if they're halfway educated, they'll say, oh, she wrote The Bell Jar, which is her famous autobiographical novel of a nervous breakdown and being institutionalized and going through shock therapy.
Oh, wow.
and a suicide attempt. And so that's what most people know about her. The casual person will say, oh, wasn't she the one who put her head in the oven? That was how she ultimately died on February 11th, 1963.
Oh, really? Why would she commit suicide? I don't understand.
Well, she was a very fragile person, and this was not her first suicide attempt.
Oh.
In The Bell Jar, she had written of a suicide attempt in her teens that basically she was going to drown herself, and she swam out kind of too far But she just couldn't do it. Her body just wouldn't stay down, was kind of how she put it.
Okay.
And she gave up. But when she was 20, she took an overdose of pills and crawled into a little crawl space in her basement and was missing for a few days. She had left a note saying she'd gone out for a walk, and you know, ponds were dragged, she was in the newspaper headlines really across the country that this beautiful young 20-year-old was missing and presumed, you know, foul play or. And then they found her. She woke up. She vomited out the pills and actually woke up. And so she was hospitalized. And that was when, you know, it was the 1950s, and their treatment was shock, electric shock therapy for most everything.
Yeah.
And she went through that for her depression. But she got better, and she came out of it. And so much of The Bell Jar is about all of that. But she was fragile, you know.
I've got to ask you, though, did she ever get back at Ted?
One might say, it's sort of a matter of how you want to look at it. But certainly he had to live with the guilt of her suicide. And then he had even more guilt after that, because the woman that he left Plath for and had a child with, she ended up dying by suicide in the exact same way and taking their daughter with her.
Oh, yeah.
So he had two suicides and the death of his daughter on his conscience. So, you know, someone might say that, you know, that Plath really got back at him just through the guilt.
Amazing.
And much of the occult Sylvia Plath, my latest book, it's sort of a four-part book. So the first part is Plath and her family and all of the practices of mysticism among them.
Was it in her family? I mean, was it passed down in her family?
Yes, yes. I mean, they definitely had a lot of interest, you know, between her and her parents of mythology and alchemy. And her father was a Freemason. And there were just many, many influences and, you know, lots of hard evidence that this all started before she met Ted. But then when she did meet him, she really took off with it. And, you know, some people say that she went too far, that she was too fragile and it was kind of too much. There's been an article, one of her editors, L. Alvarez of the London Times, he wrote an article called "Did Black Magic Kill Sylvia Plath?"
Oh.
And he was fully aware of her occult activities. And he thought that Ted, you know, encouraging her so much with the occult, you know, they were using it creatively. They were using it as a jumping off place for poetry, and they were channeling, and they were, you know, inviting spirits to help them write and this sort of thing. And she was just maybe not a strong enough individual, that she kind of went too deep.
How much do you believe in the occult?
Well, I'm a professional tarot card reader, so a lot of people would say, you know, I would say that mysticism is a strong part of my life, but I believe I'm more in love and light. I'm a teacher of A Course in Miracles.
Oh.
I study Buddhism. I study the Tao. I have a Christian background, and I embrace all of that, you know. And so, you know, Sylvia and Ted, they used Ouija boards all the time and all that stuff. I don't do that. I have a kind of my joke about the Ouija board. I say the Ouija board doesn't believe in me.
Oh.
Because I have tried it more than several times with people who claim to be masters at it,
uh-huh.
and it does not work for me at all. And my belief system about that is it's because I'm only open to positive love and light, and I'm not going to be open to just some random dark energy spirit. And Ouija boards tend to be the latter. So,
you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I've had many people over the years, because I've been doing talk shows for well over four decades, and mm-hmm. a lot of times they would say, you got to be careful with the Ouija board, because you might open a door that you don't want to have open from the other side.
I think if you're very fixed and strong in your faith, whatever that faith is, you know, if you believe you're with God, and however you deem God to be, and you are committed to a mission of being a positive in this world and in love and in light, I don't think that stuff can touch you.
Okay.
But somebody who's less, you know, less strong in themselves, and Sylvia Plath was probably that, you know, she was only 30. I'm double her age right now.
Oh, yeah.
and who I was at 30, I think I was a child, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So yeah, it kind of just depends on
I've done the Ouija board
character.
A couple of times, and you know, there was nothing. I mean, sort of, mm-hmm. it was fun, you know, and that was about it. I've been at seances sometimes, and I try to keep an open mind. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
Do I believe 100%?
Sure.
I don't know, you know, but if I'm open to the possibilities, let's do it that way.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about tarot cards. What's the ancient history behind the tarot card? I mean, who came up with this idea that each of these symbols will mean something?
Right. Well, you know, so we cannot confirm this, but the legend has it. What we can confirm first is that the oldest deck of tarot cards that we know of, you know, that's in a museum. It's in a museum in Milan today in Italy, and it came from the 14th century. And so this was in a time of the Crusades and when the Catholic Church was the government. And so other religions, like Judaism, from where Kabbalah comes from, and tarot is rooted in Kabbalah, by the way.
Oh.
And you know, some of these Romani traditions, it's not a term people use too often, too much anymore, but gypsies, you know, they believe that these traveling Romani people were taking their secrets on decks of cards, and these were encoded to look like a game that they would play with, it should government authorities question them. But, you know, so that's the lore, that they were traveling across Europe with secrets in alchemy and astrology and numerology and all of these elements that are woven into the tarot. And they were passing them along on the down low, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, so if the authorities came, they'd be like, oh, we're just playing cards.
So now, do the tarot cards tell you what you're headed toward, or has it in the past?
Yeah. So when I read a card, and I've been reading for over 45 years.
Oh, okay.
I started reading when I was 16 years old, and so it's very much part of me at this point. But I don't read for myself so much, just because I would have bias and I may project my hopes or my fears onto the cards. And so it's much better for me to read for a total stranger, or at least for somebody who I'm not necessarily invested in the answer, you know. So
did anyone ever read for you?
Oh, yeah, sometimes. Okay. And I have taught people to read for me even.
Oh, okay.
But I think anybody can read tarot cards to a certain degree. But it's, you know, certainly if you have backgrounds in like some of the religious studies that I have, or, you know, it can make for a much better reading, a reading with a lot more wisdom and guidance than somebody who's just got a book and is just saying this card means this and that card means, you know. But
is it like one card at a time, or do you have to put out a series of cards?
It depends on your question. So it's usually a spread. So my book that came out last November, Tarot Life Lessons, that really shows what a tarot card reading experience is like. These are the real life stories of my clients, and I wrote them. I actually wrote them in my journal. My working title of this book was The Tarot Diaries, because it came from my own diary of when I had a reading that just blew my mind and I didn't want to forget it. And I wrote down what cards came up, and I wrote down my clients' reactions, and I wrote down the stories. And so, you know, there are stories, the things that have come up in the cards, you know, there are scam artists, and there are people who, you know, just have terrible luck with love, and there are people with addictions, and there are people who have, there's a manslaughter case that was hidden. There's a mercy killing in there. I mean, there were some amazing stories that came out of people's tarot card readings that just blew my mind.
Wow.
So I tell them all, and it's sort of like you're sitting on my shoulder in the book, experiencing what it's like to read for these people, you know, and what's going on in my head, and also my own insecurities, because, you know, I like to say I'm not a guru. I'm not professing to have all the wisdom of the ages, and I'm not necessarily knowing what the cards are going to say, how I'm going to answer something.
How many cards are there?
Yeah, there are 78 cards, and depending on how they fall, the upright or reversed changes the meaning, and then depending on where they fall and how they interact with the other cards changes the meaning. So it's a very involved process that really takes years to master, if not decades.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I said, every card has encoded into it, you know, numerology and mythology and alchemy and, you know, all of these sorts of properties and meanings to help in this decoding. I like to compare tarot to dream analysis, because oftentimes as I'm explaining these symbols, the person I'm reading for, they're doing the real understanding because they're living the life. So they're going, oh, right, that's my boyfriend. And that's, you know, and they're kind of pulling it apart and understanding. I'm just giving them, you know, kind of the basic guidance, and they're applying it to their life.
I think one thing that everybody always worries about, am I going to get the death card? And what does the death card mean?
So the death card is not a terrible card. It's a card of transformation.
Oh.
It means the old life is behind you and you're in a whole new life. So right side up, the death card is great. You know, it's the card we get when we get married, when we graduate, if we have a baby, you know, that all of these occasions where this big event has happened, this milestone, and things will never be the same. And so that's what the death card's about. In reverse, which is upside down, it tends to be a bit of a stuckness when we want that big thing to happen, but we can't quite make it happen, you know?
Yeah. What the heck? Why do they call it the death card? That's scary.
Yeah, well, this goes back to, you know, Crusades imagery and, yeah.
I mean, they could call it transformation or something like that, but, you know, death card means, boy, I'm done, you know.
Modern tarot decks have done that, you know. Some decks, I've seen some that have a very positive spin on it, and they'll have, like, a chrysalis, you know, because, of course, the chrysalis is a kind of death when the caterpillar spins that cocoon and everything sort of falls apart inside in order for it to grow its wings and become the butterfly. And
yeah.
So that's been compared with the death card, you know, in the idea of transformation.
Amazing.
And some modern decks will even rename it entirely just to keep it positive.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Doggone it. Our time is almost up. And I'm going to have you come back so we can get a little deeper into this. But, you know, I wanted to get some ideas, you know, of what's going on. Do you believe in, like, well, you have a book called Fixed Stars, Govern of Life. Does that mean our future is in the stars?
That's actually a line from a Sylvia Plath poem that I used, because it is an analysis of Plath's poetry. So it's more of a literary criticism. That book is out of print now, but if anyone is interested in getting really into the line by line detail on Plath's poems and where I'm seeing all this imagery, they can email me and I'd be glad to sell them a copy of the PDF. For just $5.
Okay, what's your email?
My email, they can write me at, they can just go to my website and write me through that, which is juliagordonbramer.com. And that's JULIAGORDON, B as in boy, RA, M as in Mary, ER, .com.
Why don't you just...
And if they want a tarot card reading from me, they can reach out that way too.
You should just have... JGB.com. It's easier.
that would be easier. I know. My name is so gosh darn long.
That's okay. One last question. What's the difference between tarot cards and runes? I've got the rune stones.
Runes are like ancient Celtic symbols on stones. I have a bag of rune stones, but honestly, I don't know how to read them.
Oh, okay.
So that's a whole other thing.
Oh, I must have had that for like 20, 30 years. I don't know. It just sits there, and I go, I got to figure this out, you know, one of these times.
Yeah, that's a whole Eastern mystic science that I have yet to pick up. So.
Well, Julia, what are you waiting for? I'm just kidding. You got enough on your plate. So, again, it's Tarot Life Lessons and the Occult Sylvia Plath, correct?
That's correct. And yeah, those are my latest. They're both on Audible as well. So if people are not readers but they'd like to listen, I recorded them both in my own voice. They're out now. And I'm really delighted with the response. I'm in the middle of a book tour, really going to a different city through almost every week this year. So it's going to be busy.
Well, you're going to have to come back and we'll visit again. How's that?
Sounds wonderful.
Thank you so much for taking the time today. And I'm always in search of truth. And I mean that seriously. And like I said, I try and keep an open mind. I kind of, you know, my eyes roll back on my head once in a while, but most of the time it's like, hey, just give me an idea so that I can at least run with it at this point. So thank you so much. I appreciate it, Julia.
Thanks, Mary Jane. Take care.
You too. Julia Gordon Plath. Bramer, I'm sure. I'm sorry. Julia Gordon Bramer. The name of the book is The Occult Sylvia Plath, and that's Plath. Or the book on tarot is Tarot Life Lessons. So you never know. I'm always looking. Anyway, hang in there with us because we're going to talk about it. It may not make any difference. My next guest said the end of the world may be coming sooner than you think. Hang in there with us.
One of the oldest but still most effective techniques of a demagogue is to draw a sharp distinction between our tribe, us, however that is defined, and them, the others, those people who aren't quite as good, smart, wealthy, sophisticated, and on, as us. Cult leaders have used this technique to make it okay to treat those others more poorly than members of our own tribe. Psychologist Avi Tushman, in his book Our Political Nature, talks about the different ways liberals and conservatives define tribe, those like us. Conservatives, he says, tend to have a fairly narrow definition of our tribe, while liberals have a much more expansive view. We see this played out in our politics during this election year. One of the candidates talks about, quote, vermin poisoning the blood of our country, echoing Adolf Hitler, while the other one talks about bringing all Americans together. Quite a contrast, and as a psychologist, quite a confirmation of Tushman's presence, which is based on modern personality theory and was written years before the current political situation. We really haven't changed all that much in 90 years. I'm Dr. Dave Davidson-Mateau with the Mental Health Minute, a public service of Sierra Hills Individual and Family Therapy in Auburn.
Listen up, women. Heart disease kills a woman every 80 seconds, and we die of heart attacks at twice the rate of men because our symptoms are too often missed or dismissed, even by doctors. This isn't just a crisis. It's a catastrophe. Be a force for change. If you experience nausea, heartburn, extreme fatigue, shortness of breath, or pain in the chest, jaw, or neck, speak up and get your heart checked. Visit womensheartalliance.org.
All righty, let's check this one out. Is the end of the world near? You know, we've got war, famine, climate changes, hate, wealth disparities, political insanity. So is civilization doomed? Well, we're going to explore that with Dr. John Mills, psychoanalyst, clinical psychologist, philosopher, and honorary professor at the Department of Psychosocial and Psychoanalytic Studies at the University of Essex in the UK. So here we go. Author of The End of the World, Civilization and Its Faith. Nice to have you with us, Dr. Mills. It's kind of scary when you think about it. Are we headed in a bad way?
Well, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not overly optimistic about the way our civilization is developing here. It is scary times, and it's times for concern. It's not, of course, time to panic and think that everything is going to be doomed and blow up tomorrow. But if we don't start having some serious conversations about the plight of our planet and of our world at large, then we may be headed toward some type of major social collapse.
I mean, do you think we have a death wish?
Well, let's try to understand what we mean by that. That are we engaging in behavior, whether it be actively, passively, or psychologically, where we're failing to address the multitude of our emergencies? So, meaning the climate crisis, the geopolitical warfare that's taking place, the AI revolution, the social disparities, and you know, and all these things that we there's so many multipliers. Are we failing to act? And if we are failing to act or take responsibility for this looming catastrophe, are we engaging in self-destructive behavior? So the question of do we have a death wish is really about why are we failing to intervene that in such a way that if we do not, it can bring about our own demise.
But, you know, Dr. Mills, we've always had some problems. I mean, you take any century and there were problems. But the thing is it like multiplied by who knows what, by being, you know, on top of each other? All these things are coming together to end the world as we know it. And I don't know if it'll be ever, I mean, the planet's not going to blow up, but Mother Nature might take it out on us too and just say, hey, we need to get rid of them and start over.
Yeah, well, that is one of the worries, that if we continue to stick our head in the sand and not do something about, you know, our climate crisis, the world will overheat. I mean, it's 127 degrees in India as we speak, and people are dropping like flies. You know, infrastructures, power grids, everything would collapse if we continue to not in some ways mitigate the climate crisis. But I'm not trying to suggest that that the world will completely end. It's just that using a bit of a theatrical title, wanting to grab people's attention, of course there are some people do believe that you know, the eschaton will occur, and perhaps some more Islamic extremists might want to try to bring that about in the Middle East, but for the most part, I'm not predicting that we're going to be leaving the planet anytime soon.
Well, you know, it has been said, though, Dr. Mills, that we don't know how many times civilization has ended and started over again. That there could we could have been two times, three times, four. Who knows?
Well, yes, there are many civilizations that have died due to social collapse, a number of things in our human history time frame. So it's not certainly out of the question that we might see a more modern day doomsday scenario where, you know, failing to take care of our alma mater, our Mother Earth, may lead to you know, mass societal collapses in various parts of the globe, which in today's interconnected globalized world would have immediate effects on everybody involved.
Mm. The other thing, too, is there are a lot of people who say, as far as the environmental issue, because there – well, I shouldn't say issue, because there are issues, quite a few. But – they say we've passed it. We've gone past where we can reverse it. All we can do is try and do the best we can for what we've got. How do you feel about that? Is it irreversible or is it reversible?
Well, I have to stay within my realm of expertise, so I'm certainly not an earth scientist or a climate expert. But if we're going to listen to the thousands of scientists who inform the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's warnings, then we are certainly approaching a tipping point where even if we were to get our emissions under control, that it will still have future pernicious consequences on the world climate.
Gotcha.
So I think at this point that this is the time when societies need to work more in concert with one another in order to bring about some unified consensus about what we need to do.
But you know, Dr. Mills, I got to be honest with you. Yeah, this is the day that we were actually taping this show, or this week was the celebration in Normandy 80 years ago, which was the beginning of the end of World War II. But it was a time when it wasn't a me generation, it was an us, a we generation. They worked together to do things. It's just the opposite now. I mean, we've got, you know, Russia and the Ukraine. We've got Hamas and Israel. We've got North and South Korea. We've got China rattling swords. It just seems like we're on the precipice of just something that's going to be so catastrophic, and everybody's going to say, I didn't see it coming. But it was coming.
We see it coming. We see the train approaching, and yet we seem to not be taking this danger seriously and getting off the track. But we also need to stop it from coming. And one thing I do predict in the book is that there's bound to be another world war, especially given the current times, where there's everything from psychopathy in our national leaders, throughout the globe, and when that happens, we cannot predict how people will act, because we're certainly not acting based on the reality principle now. Just think when people who are completely unhinged and unpredictable have control on initiating, let's say, some nuclear engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly scary. The mere fact that that all the superpowers involved are modernizing their nuclear arsenals rather than dismantling them. And so it puts everybody on edge. And then when there's, of course, regional conflicts that then affect everything from the price of grain to the availability of a supply chain getting you a computer chip.
Yeah.
This is what has immediate impacts on the the economic structures of society and the availability of goods and services and just basic commodities.
Yeah.
So
in the prologue of your book, you say that we all have the need to find enemies. Really? And why?
Well, I think this is part of human nature. Meaning that the typically men that are running the world are not gentle, loving creatures by nature. That there is the expression of whether it be covert or overt forms of aggression, of violence, of the need to inflict pain onto others, and cruelty, and sadism. And these are, the need to destroy is reflective on some level of, you know, of our psychological constitutions. Of course, that means it's evolutionarily informed. This is a concern. The presence of evil, it just seems to be proliferating in all pockets of society. And, of course, they're with the need to find an enemy or a scapegoat or a bad object or a whipping boy to take out every single frustration that one's experienced, including their own traumas and suffering. It's rather difficult to imagine a world that is going to be free of the natural propensity for aggression.
Hmm.
But it doesn't mean that there's not the other side, the need for, you know, love and affiliation and connection to others and cooperation. And
that seems to be beaten down by this new form of acceptability, which is called evil. And define evil.
Well, it's funny. The term, you know, does certainly have a certain a biblical overtone to it. But actually, the word comes from an Indo-European term for shit, caca. And hence, the transliteration is basically something that's bad.
Oh.
But evil, of course, is something that is even debated today in scholarship. So let's just, for our argument, say that it's willfully, you know, inflicting pain and suffering onto others.
Hmm. So what do we do about it? I mean, the average person who's listening to this show, and myself included, you know, I'm just one little part of this world, not even a speck of sand on a beach. You know? So what can I do to change it? Is there a way to change it anymore, or have we gone too far?
I don't think we've gone too far. I think we have to, first of all, you know, have open discussions about our serious social and global plight. As long as people want to remain unconscious, where they don't even feel the need to talk about these things or engage in certain defensive strategies such as, you know, denial and disavowal and intellectualize things away or rationalize or simply just dissociate because it's just too much to cognitively comprehend. But by having, like, these serious open discussions and debates and dialogues, it is really the first step. How do we awaken a planetary ecological consciousness? There's many things that one can do about that, particularly if they want to start electing certain leaders and politicians who are taking the citizens' concerns to heart and not merely...
Before I get your read on politicians, you know, well, I'm sure we're going to agree on some of those things, but you say about talking. But we don't talk with each other anymore. We talk at each other instead of with. Until we can get to that with, nothing. I mean, we're so divided, polarized, unbelievable. If you don't believe what I believe in, you should die. You know, it's just that. It's that stark.
Yes. That's a very primitive defense mechanism we call splitting. There's only one side that's good and the other's bad.
Yeah.
And these types of divisions, these animosities that are just carelessly cast upon the other or alterity without even recognizing that they're a human being that has competing different needs and identities that you have, we have to start with the fact that we're more similar than we are dissimilar, in terms of our needs and values. But I certainly agree with you that it's become almost impossible to have civil conversation based upon a clash of values.
I don't even know what the values are anymore. It's not even with values, because they all claim they've got values. Both sides claim, there's more than one side, I realize that, but say for our sake talking today, our values. I've got values, you've got values, we may disagree on some things, but we all have values. That doesn't bring us together.
Yeah, that's, you've reminded me of Immanuel Kant's famous book on perpetual peace, where he asked, how do we get nations to come together in peace? And he has the concept of hospitality. And so the notion is, how do we get people to come together to the table to share some good food and conversation and break bread together without resulting into some kind of duel or to the death.
Yeah, they'd rather break necks than break bread.
Yes, it's also a time in history where like you and I, I'm sure we didn't grow up with the internet. Whereas at least my children were born immediately into it. And so the way we relate to one another through social media has really got its downside, that's for sure, even though there are many advances in technology that have offered us having a better life, that to such a degree as if you have disinformation where you can't even know what's true from what's not.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention if you have, people who are bad actors who are intent on disrupting critical information structures or communication networks or cyber hacking or whatever, internet espionage, stealing your data, spoon feeding the ignorant masses about what's happening out there because nobody reads news and they get everything from their social media or X.
Nobody fact checks anymore. They don't look it up to see if it's true or not. They just follow blindly. I have a belief. I think we've lost hope. Is there anything to look forward to? I don't care about me. I'm old. I don't care. But the young people that are growing up, do they have hope anymore? Are they looking forward to anything anymore? And if you don't have those two things, what's the sense in being here?
Well, I think you capture a certain climate of nihilism that has, infested the social collectives in such a negative way that many of them don't feel that they have a future.
Yeah.
But of course we're all individuals and we all have the responsibility to live our own lives and to find meaning and fulfillment in it and to become our possibilities. Some are going to be able to achieve that more than others. And if you don't have hope for the future, then it could be a dismal, process like you just explained.
Mm-hmm. I don't think you don't think very much of politicians, do you? I mean, I don't, but what about you? We lost him. Isn't that amazing? You know what? Maybe those politicians who were listening didn't want to hear the answer. Hey, hang in there with us, folks. I'll call him right back.
More than 6 million kids in the U.S. have ADHD, and many aren't getting the support they need. At understood.org, we can help. Sometimes in class, the only thing your child can focus on are the thoughts racing through their head.
Why am I always falling behind? Why do I feel so alone? So different?
Your child is looking to you for answers. But as a parent, you probably have a lot of questions too. What should I do next? Where do I even start? At understood.org, we provide parents with the resources they need to help kids with ADHD thrive. Your child wants to thrive. Be the reason they do. Visit understood.org/the reason to get started.
Well, I got him back. Hi, Dr. Mills. I got you back again. I think those politicians were listening to us and they didn't want to hear what you have to say about them. But my question was, you don't think a whole lot about politicians, anything positive, and neither do I. And I'm not sure most people do.
Well, yeah, that might be because of my own unresolved neurosis growing up in a political family.
Oh, you did?
But, yeah. I don't know if I would want to characterize having disdain for all politicians, but it almost seems like anyone who would even want to govern would have to be strongly either motivated by their principles, that they would feel they can make it a real positive difference in society, or they're driven by their own narcissism.
Or nuts. So, nuts to go into the biz, because there's nothing that can be hidden from people today. And I think a lot of good people don't want to be politicians because they know they're going to be scrutinized. And every second of their life is going to be scrutinized. And I don't think they want to do it anymore. It's not worth it to them, even though they may believe in something higher or better than themselves.
Yeah, well put.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you want people to do? We got about 2 minutes here. 2 minutes. Tell me what you want people to do.
Well, I certainly don't like to throw out platitudes.
Go ahead. You can do it. It's okay.
I think, first of all, we need to become self-aware of what's really happening rather than engaging in denial and defensiveness around certain inconvenient facts or truths that we don't want to accept. This is like the need to overcome these internal resistances. We need to listen to the other. We need to get out of our comfort zone. And because if you start listening to other people's perspectives, you'll understand where they're coming from. And given that, you know, this took me about, I don't know, close to 30 years of research before I ended up writing this, having to study many different fields, interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary fields, I was just as clueless until I realized the predicament we're in. So having the conversation.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to interrupt you because our conversation has come to an end, and I want to make sure we get your website in here.
Well, yes, you can find me at philosophypsychoanalysis.com, or you just, you know, Google me, John Mills with a J-O-N, Mills, and I'll come up, I'm sure, on the web.
And End of the World is available all the normal places?
Sure. It's published with Roman and Littlefield. It just came out. You can get it online. You can order through Amazon or any of the major bookstores that will have it.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Mills, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. You know, we try to do the best we can, but I guess it's the old saying, you got to keep working at it, and you just don't give up until things go in the positive way. So thank you so much for being with us on the show.
Oh, my pleasure, and with gratitude.
Thank you. And again, folks, stay with us. Got a little bit of news going, and then we're going to talk about some of these issues with internationally renowned psychic medium Joyce Keller.